very interesting reading, and it began to be interesting to see what Sean brings from that reading today for us. I look forward to hearing it. So when you're ready, Minister Sean.
Shabbat shalom, everyone. I've got to use the mic today because I left the other mic at home because I took it home by accident last week. So I won't be able to walk around like I normally do. That drives everybody crazy. It doesn't really. Okay. Let's pray. Abba and Elohim of our fathers, we ask that your word would go forth today and no one else's. Ask that your shalom would be upon our hearts and our minds, that we would receive from you what you would have to speak to us. You'll block anything that's not what you want to say to our hearts at this specific time, that we would hear only your word to us. Blessed be your holy name. Prepare our hearts and our minds to hear what you have to say to us. Amen. This parasha constitutes Numbers 19 through 22:1. This parasha is the shortest weekly Torah portion in the book of Bamidbar and is made up of 4,670 Hebrew letters, 1,245 Hebrew words, 87 verses, can occupy 159 lines in the Torah scroll. Would you like to play the first video, please?
Today's portion is from Numbers 19:1, 22:1. It is called Hakat, which means decree. God instructs a ritual law and sacrifice of the red heifer to create water of lustration. The cow was to be burned in its entirety, and ashes were to be used in the creation of the water of lustration. Touching the corpse of any human being was unclean. After 7 days, a person could become clean again. The cow water was used for cleansing. Failing to cleanse resulted in being kicked out. Miriam kicked the bucket and was buried. The people were thirsty and complained. God shows up and tells Moses to speak to the rock for water. Moses, in anger, yells, "Listen, you rebels, shall we get water for you out of this rock?" Moses nunchucks the rock twice and water comes out. Because he fails to obey God's instruction, Moses and Aaron cannot enter the promised land. Aaron goes up on a mountain and dies, and everyone cries for 30 days. The king of Arad picks a fight and loses. The people complain, and God lets loose serpents that kill many of the Israelites. People repent, and Moses sets up a serpent on a stick that heals people when they look at it. The Amorites won't let Israel pass, pick a fight, and get destroyed. King Og fights and loses as well. Israelites cross the Jordan from Jericho, and that is Hakat in 60 seconds.
Okay, this parasha is obviously a very interesting parasha. There's a lot in it. But I just want to focus on a couple of issues this day. So what I'll do is I'll just play the next video now from Rabbi Benny. Could you turn the lights off too, please?
Welcome to the Kabbalah Jewish Center's video blog, the Torah portion of Hukat. So how does one summarize the entire Torah in a nutshell? Like, what's the underlying theme to being a Jew and following God's ways? Does one need to practice deep meditation atop a high mountain? Perhaps survive a chillant overdose on a Shabbat afternoon? Maybe diligently study Yiddish proverbs? Chasene hoben zoller mit malachamovas' tochter, zoller storben von naches. What is the central idea that the Torah brings to humanity which didn't exist before Mount Sinai? Well, would you believe that in the beginning of this week's Torah portion, we're given the answer?
Right here. Right there.
The bizarre laws regarding the red heifer, or the red cow, for all those who didn't grow up in yeshiva and never heard the word heifer before. In the Torah, to touch a dead corpse, one became ritually impure and was unable to enter into the tabernacle or the temple for sacrifices or any other services or gifts to God. Well, then how would they be allowed in again? How could they become purified in order to serve God properly?
Okay, so you're ready for this?
To do this, they needed to get sprinkled by special water mixed with some plants and the ashes of a cow that was fully red, the red heifer. If just a single drop of the special water touched them on the required days of purification, then they became pure again, and they can finally be included in all the services as before.
Gee, I wonder how they can be incorporated in my own life.
I got a boo-boo on my finger.
You have a boo-boo on your finger?
Yeah.
Well, give me your finger.
Oh, this is moldy!
Delicious!
But these weren't some kind of magical waters. In fact, The impurity itself didn't make any kind of physical defect either. We're talking about a totally spiritual idea here. The impurity was a spiritual energy of death that lingered upon anyone who came in contact with a corpse. And this red cow ash water mixture was given the powers to remove that impure energy. Nothing magical at all. But in truth, this commandment is the one most associated with the category of chukim. Those commandments which have no rational reasoning. Their only observance is simply because that's what God wants. While most commentaries suggest different types of reasonings behind most of the chol commandments, this one by far is the most baffling and mysterious. In fact, our rabbis tell us that only Moses himself was granted the knowledge in God's reasoning for this commandment.
Really? That's the reason? Oh, almighty!
Interestingly though, in the opening words of the portion, we read, Zot Chukat HaTorah. This is the statute of the Torah. As if this particular mitzvah is the statute of the Torah, representing everything the Torah stands for. And the obvious question is, huh? How does the command to sprinkle water on impure people become the prime example of the Torah's standards and purpose? Well, one of the weird details of this commandment is that whenever somebody participated in the procedure of purifying others, he himself became impure. Like when the guy sprinkled the ashes on impure people and he made them pure, he himself became impure in the process. And that, my friends, is the reason that this is such a shining example of what the Torah stands for. Imagine the scene. Some Jewish guys come in contact with negative forces and energies. They could have very well been hanging around places they never should have been. They've fallen spiritually and are now asking to be helped back up so that they can return to experience God in his home. And then, a priest who's probably never met them before.
So, where are you from? Oh, very nice. I had a cousin who was once there. Years ago. I heard it's chilly up there. Well, here it's hot.
He agrees to become impure himself, just to help lift up some unknown fellow Jews. This is the purpose of the entire Torah. We all have our comfort zones in life. They may even be God-given gifts and rights, like the Kohanim, the priests, who are given the job to serve in God's holy home. But the Torah's entire purpose is to put aside our comforts, and yes, even to fall and suffer a little, just to help somebody else, maybe even a total stranger, to get back up and fulfill his or her purpose of existence. In this age of I, where happiness is seemingly achieved by fulfilling my dreams and being occupied with whatever makes me feel good, we can sure use a good dose of this week's Torah portion. Okay, that wasn't funny. Oh. Put yourself to the side a little bit. Lower yourself from the elevated level in which you find yourself in order to help somebody you may not even know.
I mean, it's so hot that sometimes I just...
Okay. So very clearly, this Torah portion is about the Messiah. The red heifer represents the Messiah, even the fact that it's red, of this earth. Edom, Adam. The Yeshua was the second Adam. Huh? The Yeshua offered himself, came down as a pure and holy sacrifice to become unclean on our behalf in order to lift us up and make us clean. That's pretty much it with the red heifer, isn't it? It's pretty straightforward. I mean, there's lots of other stuff, but we're not going to go into that. So I liked his take on it. I thought it was very true. I just want to focus on now, I just want to show a video on the name, because we've had a bit of a discussion about this in the past, and by Nehemiah Gordon, just so everybody's clear on why we say the name the way we say the name. So I'm just going to show a short, well, a reasonable video on the name. So if you'd like to play number two, you know, number three, whatever it is.
So, and God said unto Moses, I am that I am. And in Hebrew, it's actually ahiyeh asher ahiyeh, which is more like I will be that which I will be, but that's not the key point. And he said, thus shall you say unto the children of Israel, I am hath sent me unto you. Okay, so I am is the name, according to Exodus 3:14.
Yeah.
Okay, even in Hebrew, ahiyeh is certainly referring to him. Let's put it that way. And then verse 15, and God said moreover unto Moses, thus shall thou say unto the children of Israel, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial to all generations. Well, there's no name in verse 15, so the name must be the I am of verse 14. And so
I've heard it argued such.
And correctly so, based on the English here of the King James. Meaning, if you're basing it on what you're reading in the English of the King James, that is actually correct. That the name is Ehyeh, I am. However, when you read it in Hebrew, instead of Lord God, in verse 15, what it actually says is, Vayomer od Elohim el Moshe, and Elohim, God, said further to Moses, Ko tomar el bnei Israel, so shall you say to the children of Israel, Yehovah Elohei avotechem, Yehovah, the God of your fathers, etc., has sent me to you. Zeshmi leolam vezezichri ledor vador. This is my name forever. This is my memorial, or literally mention, for generation to generation. So what is God's mention? What is his name? His actual name is Yehovah. And what is Ehyeh? So Ehyeh in verse 14 is the explanation of the name. You wouldn't know that in English, but in Hebrew it's obvious. Because Yehovah, the name, is a combination of three forms of the verb to be. It's Hayah, he was, Hoveh, he is, and Yehyeh, he is to come or he will be. Now, every Jew knows that's the meaning of the name. What's really interesting is recently I had a discussion with Binyamin Tzedakah. He is the top Samaritan scholar in the world. He's written 108 books, this guy. And he says to me something really interesting, and we'll get back to him hopefully later. But he says to me, do you know what the name means? I said, I know what it means, but you're a Samaritan. What do you think it means, right? And he says to me, it means he was, he is to come. He will be. Hayahoveh, he was, he is, he will be. So the Jews know this and the Samaritans know it. You know where else you find this, Michael? I think you do know. It's in the book of Revelation. So you have the book of Revelation has he was, he is to come, or he will be. He is to come is a translation essentially of Yehyeh, he will be. And so you have this in the Jews, the Samaritans, and the New Testament. Now you can't tell me, well, the Jews looked in the book of Revelation, that's where they got it. Obviously, they got it from a common source, right? And the Samaritans certainly aren't getting it from the Jews. So where are they all getting this from? So I asked this to Benjamin Tzedakah, how do you know that's what it means? And he said, it's obvious from Exodus 3:14. So he's a second witness.
Okay.
I said that for years. When you read it in Hebrew, Ehyeh, I will be, is the explanation of the name Yehovah. How is it an explanation? Well, this has to do with how Hebrew verbs are structured. So essentially, you take those three forms of the verb, Hayahoveh, Yeh, you combine them, and you get Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, God's personal name. God's personal name. And that's why he says, he's saying, I will be, has sent me. And then he explains, okay, just so you know, that's just a one-time title for now. But my name for generation to generation, my eternal name is Yehovah. That's his eternal name. That's what Exodus 3:14-15 means. Now, whose contents are these? So we have a letter that the Samaritan sent sometime around 168 or 175 BC, sometime in that period, to Antiochus Epiphanes IV. And by the way, the Seleucid governor, or the Seleucid king, our emperor, his name was Antiochus Epiphanes. What does Epiphanes mean? It means the one who reveals himself. So he claimed to be a god, Antiochus. Right. So they write to Antiochus an epistle whose contents are these. To King Antiochus the god, Epiphanes, meaning the one who reveals himself, a memorial from the Sidonians who live at Shechem, meaning straight off they're saying, we're actually not Israelites, we just live here.
Ah.
Our forefathers, upon certain frequent plagues, mentioned in 2 Kings 17, and as following a certain ancient superstition, had a custom of observing that day, which by the Jews is called the Sabbath. In other words, what they're saying is we only worship Shabbat because we were attacked by lions. And it was the Jewish superstition, and this isn't really something we believe in, we're just doing it. Now look, I'm not saying the Samaritans today believe this, but according to Josephus, this is a letter that was sent sometime around 168 BC. And when they had erected a temple at the mountain called Gerizim, though without a name, they offered upon it the proper sacrifices. What does that mean, without a name? So what that means, without a name, is that if you know, it's not ignorance. It's actually very deliberate. The temple in Jerusalem is referred to as the place Yehovah chose to put his name. It's also called the place Yehovah caused his name to dwell. And they're telling us around 168 or 175 BC, we have a temple, Gerizim, which follows the sacrifices of the Torah, but we don't call the name of the God of Israel upon this temple. Because it's not the place he put his name. They understood that. Give them some credit that they understood that.
Yeah.
meaning they understood Jerusalem was the place where God put his name forever. Now upon the just treatments of these wicked Jews, those that manage their affairs, supposing that we were of kin to them, in other words, your governor who thinks we're Jews, doesn't know the difference between Samaritans and Jews, and practice as they do, make us liable to the same accusations, although we are originally Sidonians, as is evident from the public records. I mean, you can check in your own records to see we're foreigners in the land of Israel. We don't come from here. We were brought from some other land. 2 Kings 17. Section verse 261 in Josephus here. We therefore beseech thee, our benefactor and savior, referring to the king, to give order to Apollonius, the governor of this part of the country, and to Nicanor, the procurator of your affairs, to give us no disturbance, nor to lay our charge what the Jews are accused for, since we are aliens from their nation and from their customs, right? We're just doing the Sabbath and sacrifice thing because there was a superstition by our ancestors when we were attacked by lions, but we're not Israelites. And then they say, but let our temple, which at present has no name at all, be named the Temple of Jupiter Hellenius. Whoa.
Wow.
So what are they doing here? They figure out, they're not stupid, they realize why the Jews are being persecuted. The key, and so remember what happened at Hanukkah with the Maccabees.
Yeah, they put the statue of Jupiter on the Temple Mount on Jupiter's birthday, December 25th, declaring Jupiter to be God.
My understanding there is the focus was on Apollo, but in any event, what the Greeks are trying to...
Well, it's the same name.
They mix all these things, right? Yeah. Well, so what they're doing back then, the Greeks wanted to wipe out the Jews, but not in the way that other people, not the way the Nazis wanted to wipe out the Jews. What the Nazis wanted to do is kill every last Jew. What the Greeks wanted to do is assimilate the Jews and make them Greeks.
Right.
And so they came along to the Jews and they said, look, stop your Shabbat. Stop circumcising your children. You have these things that make you distinct from other nations. We just want you to be Greeks. We want you to be part of our empire. And how will we make you part of our empire? Everyone's the same. So why rebel? We're just all the same, right? This is assimilation. Radical assimilation, right? I mean, Jews came to America and we learned to speak English and we follow the laws and we're loyal to the country. We're assimilated in that sense, but we still maintain our own distinctiveness. We keep Shabbat, those who are follow the Torah. Mm-hmm. Here they wanted to wipe out the faith of the Jews by making the things the Greeks did to us is they said, you must not speak the name of your God. Now, why would the Greeks care if we speak the name of our God? Because we want everybody just to worship God. Right? Just call him Theos. Just call him Kurios. Just call him Lord and God. And then we can all pretend we worship the same God. And after a few generations, who will remember that you guys are distinct? We'll have this big salad that mixes up and you'll call him God. Well, you can say it, believe in your heart that God is Yehovah. We don't care about that, but don't speak it. Because if you speak it, you make it real. And if you just pretend it's the same name, after a few generations, your descendants will forget and will be one nation. This was the goal of the Greeks. So the Samaritans hear this and they say, we don't even use God's name. Let's just call him Zeus, which they translate here as Jupiter. Essentially, it's Zeus. Zeus of the Greeks. We don't care. We'll put any name you want in the temple. Just don't persecute us. Right? Why are we keeping Shabbat? Because lions attacked us. You know, now we're being attacked by men, by humans, by Greeks. We want that to stop. It hurts. You know, what are we going to do? We'll just not call the temple by that name, which is really amazing because we have this coin here. Can I show you this coin, Michael?
This is a coin
that was uncovered by archaeologists. It's a coin that shows the Mount Gerizim. And on top of Mount Gerizim, and what's really cool is archaeologists have excavated. It's a coin from Shechem, from Nablus, and it shows Mount Gerizim. That's what we're seeing here in the middle. And on top is a temple. And there's steps leading up to the temple because Shechem is in the valley and Mount Gerizim is up on the hill. And those steps were discovered by archaeologists. So you have a coin and you find some, and the temple was found by archaeologists. That's a temple to Jupiter on top of Mount Gerizim. That's on their coins. So the Samaritans started out worshiping the God of Israel and some local deity, but they didn't call the God of Israel by his name, according to their own word and confirmed by Josephus. And then they come along and they're being persecuted. They said, we'll just call him Zeus or Jupiter. We don't care. Just stop hurting us. Stop persecuting us. Right? We're not the Israelites that we care that much. You know, back then at least. I'm sure they care now, right? But and they still don't call him by his name. But so back then they start worshiping this God and they start calling him Zeus and Jupiter. And hopefully in the second half we'll get back to the people where Yahweh comes from.
Okay, please do.
Because for 200 years the world has been deceived. And not really the Jewish world. The Jewish world doesn't know anything about this. The academic scholarly world, which then spilled over into the Christian world, has been deceived by this information I think it's deception. And when I dug into where it came from, I was shocked, because where it came from is Gesenius. Gesenius is the great grammarian of Hebrew grammar. To this day, the primary lexicons of biblical Hebrew, Brown Diver Briggs and Haylott, Hebrew and Aramaic Lexicon of the Old Testament, are based on the work of Gesenius in the 1800s. And the primary grammar at Hebrew University, I would sit with these in these classes, and these the professor would assign an assignment to go check in the Hebrew grammar. And the grammar of biblical Hebrew isn't in Hebrew. It's in English or German, written by Gesenius. So we had students I was sitting with who were native Hebrew speakers who would come to me and say, can you help us? Our English isn't good enough. Help. I'm like, yeah, I could read this. You know, it's English. It's my native language. And so Gesenius's Hebrew grammar is really the foundation of modern Hebrew, of biblical studies in Hebrew.
And even today at Hebrew University.
At Hebrew University, and rightfully so. He did groundbreaking work. What he really did is he collected things that were done by other people over centuries, and he put them, as Germans are quite good at doing, and especially in the past, is doing things in a systematic way. Mm-hmm. And so he was very systematic. He is wonderful. I consult Gesenius almost every day, Michael. I'm not saying he's a bad grammar. I'm just saying he didn't get everything right. And if you look at the earlier versions of his dictionary in particular, you get a glimpse into his thought pattern. So he was the one who championed Yahweh and convinced the scholarly world it should be Yahweh. Because it was a debate in the Christian world up until then. Meaning Yahweh doesn't appear until 1599. That's the first time it appears in the writings of a man named Gilbert Genebard. And then it's debated for a couple hundred years by the Christians that Yehovah, which the Jews seem to think it is, or is it Yahweh? And then Gesenius ends the discussion as Yahweh. And he brings two pieces of evidence, which shocked me because I didn't know this until relatively recently. And he says this in the 1833 edition of his dictionary, which was translated in 1857 into English. And in the dictionary, this part I actually didn't know, the first part. So the first part is that the main source for Yahweh is a Christian church father named Theodoret of Cyrus, who lived at the end of the 4th, beginning of the 5th century AD. And what Theodoret of Cyrus says is he's talking about the name, and he makes a statement that is quoted in certainly every scholarly work on this topic as evidence for Yahweh. And what Theodoret says in his questions on Exodus chapter 7, question number 15, he says, the Samaritans call it Yahweh, while the Jews call it Ayah, which is really interesting because at first you think he's talking about the Tetragrammaton, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Right? Mm. And that's what's understood certainly when it comes to the Samaritans. But he says the Jews call God's name Ayah. Well, what's Ayah? So years ago I suggested that Ayah, which supposedly the Jews refer to God as, was a corruption of the Yah that you have in Hallelujah. And that's definitely a possibility. Meaning he's not even talking about the Tetragrammaton when it comes to the Jews. Because by the time of Theodoret of Cyrus, there were very small number of Jews who still spoke the name. It was kept as a secret among the rabbis. And certainly this Gentile wouldn't have heard it. Like, that makes no sense that this Christian from from Cyrus and Theodoret, not Cyprus, by the way, that he would have heard this. It doesn't make sense. So where did they hear this from? And how did he get this information from the Samaritans? Remember, we just heard from Josephus that in 168 BC, the Samaritans didn't speak the name of the God of Israel. In fact, they had they referred to God by no name, anonymous, and then they rededicated their temple to Zeus or Jupiter. So that was 168 BC, and now we're being told sometime around 500 AD by Theodoret of Cyrus, that's 700 years later, that the Samaritans pronounced God's name as Yahweh. So where does he get that? So there's a number of possibilities. One is, well, maybe there was some faction of Samaritans who did speak it. I don't know. There isn't really evidence for that. What some scholars suggest, and by the way, this is Gesenius' basis for Yahweh. This statement by Theodoret, what I just read to you, that is the only solid proof of any kind for Yahweh. This statement by Theodoret, who's quoting the Samaritans. By the way, Theodoret didn't know Hebrew. The Samaritans weren't even Israelites, so their form of Hebrew is a corrupt form of Hebrew based on the northern dialect, but it was corrupted over time. They don't have the hey sound, for example. This gentleman, the scholar, Samaritan scholar, he says to me, the name of God means Hayahoveh. Yeah, I said, well, how do you pronounce it in Samaritan Hebrew? Hayah, he says, is Abba. Hoveh, he says, is Ebi. Yihyeh is Yebi. right? So you can see some like some remnant there of Hebrew, but their Hebrew is different than the Hebrew that was preserved by the Jewish people. It comes from a different dialect, and that was corrupted over time. So how on earth does Theodoret know what the Samaritans call the God of Israel? So one possibility is that, you know, he heard them say some other word, and he just didn't really, or he heard maybe third or fourth hand, right? Because I doubt he ever met a Samaritan. So somehow the word gets to him that they refer to God as Yahweh or Yahweh. What they might have actually been referring to is what we saw in Exodus 3:14, and other scholars have suggested this. That in Exodus 3:14, we saw that God is called Ehyeh. He says, I am, and then he says, this is what you'll call me for the rest of time, is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, which is he was, he is, he will be. But Yahweh actually would be pronounced in certain periods of history of Greek as Iaveh. Well, Iaveh could be a form of Ehyeh. And that's what some scholars have suggested. This is simply a corruption of Ehyeh and has therefore nothing to do with the Tetragrammaton. Because in this period, the Samaritans didn't even speak the name. There's another possibility, which I find really scary. And it's possible this is true. So, the Samaritans we heard about from Josephus rededicated their temple to Jupiter. Well, what's Jupiter called in Latin? In Latin, he's not called Jupiter. First of all, there's no J in Latin, right? So in Latin, he's called Jupiter. And I actually spoke to an expert in Latin to confirm this. So today in Latin, they say Jove or Jove for Jupiter.
Right.
But in early, and that's where you get in English where, you know, where Sherlock Holmes says, oh, by Jove, I think I've got it. He's saying by Jupiter. What are you saying? You're saying by Jupiter. That's what he was saying. Can you believe that? I don't know what the English were thinking back then in the 1800s. But anyway, there's different forms of Jupiter. And I don't want to get too complicated here, but there are different what they call cases in Latin. So there's Jupiter, Jovis, Jovi, Jovum, Jove, Jupiter. But basically in the early Latin, it wasn't a V, it was a W. And so it wasn't pronounced Jove, it was pronounced Jove in Latin 2,000 years ago. So now we have this word Yoweh, and where do we get Jupiter from Yoweh? Jupiter is Yoepater, Father Yoweh. That is the name of Jupiter that was the god of the Latins, Yoweh. And I heard that, I'm like, that sounds awfully like Yahweh. And we know that the Samaritans dedicated their temple to Jupiter, Jupiter of the Greeks. So maybe if you went to a Samaritan and said, what's the name of the god in that temple? He would say to you, that's Father Yoweh, Yoepater. So wait a minute. So maybe this is what they heard from the Samaritans. It's just not the name of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the God of Israel. Now you say, okay, come on. Gesenius isn't going to fall for that. He knew Greek. He knew Latin. He learned Greek and Latin before he learned Hebrew. He was a, you know, a solid German scholar back then. Even in your day, I think people learned Latin, right? And it, you know, in the earlier generations, Europeans and people from the West learned Greek and Latin really well. Mm-hmm. And so he knew about Yoweh being the name of Jupiter, and you think, how could there be any connection between what he said, what Gesenius, this great German scholar of Hebraic studies, said, and Jupiter? Well, he actually admits that there is. Let me read you what he says. And I heard, saw this, and I'm like, there it is. It's a smoking gun. These are the words of Gesenius in his 1857 edition of his dictionary. He says, I suppose this word, referring to Yahweh, and earlier in the paragraph, he says, hey, this comes from the Samaritans, Yahweh, which is Yahweh. I suppose this word to be one of the most remote antiquity, perhaps is the same origin as Jovis, which is Jovis, and Jupiter, meaning Jove and Jupiter, and transferred from the Egyptians to the Hebrews. So, what? So in other words, Gesenius is telling us we have two pieces of information here. We have a god, we have a name for God from the Samaritans, which is Yahweh, which sounds awfully like, which he believes would originally have been Yahweh, and Yahweh sounds awfully like Yoweh of the Latins. And we have this statement by Theodoret connecting it to the Samaritan Yahweh, which he thinks is Yahweh, and we have this Latin god called Yoweh. He says these two things can't be a coincidence. It must be that both the Hebrews and the Latins come from some worship some ancient deity who is called Yoweh or Yahweh, And they both then separated into different places. The Latins went to Italy. The Israelites went to Israel. And they both continued to call upon this name with a slightly different pronunciation. The Latins as Yahweh and the Hebrews as Yahweh.
And he's suggesting that it came from the Egyptians?
And it came from the Egyptians, he claims. Now, he says, wrote this originally in 1833, and that's significant, because at that time, they didn't really know what hieroglyphics meant. You know, in other words, they hadn't fully deciphered the hieroglyphics. Mm-hmm. And so you could kind of say anything you wanted about the ancient Egyptians, right?
They did, right?
Right. I mean, famously, there was one particular group who said, "Yes, we have this document in hieroglyphics. Here's our translation of it." Turns out they just made that all up. Once scholars actually deciphered hieroglyphics.
That's embarrassing for Salt Lake City.
Yeah, you said that. In any event, so here you have him saying explicitly he's tying together Yahweh of the Samaritans in Theodoret. And the Yahweh of Jupiter of the Latins, and saying, yeah, they both got that from the Egyptians. Well, I saw this. I said, wait a minute. So your proof for Yahweh, the great scholar who advocates for Yahweh, is telling us it's the name of a pagan deity, and it's the name of some Egyptian deity that both the Latins and the Hebrews worship? Well, first of all, it's the name of a pagan deity, then it doesn't mean he was, he is, and he is to come.
Right.
And he claims it doesn't mean that, because he bases it on a Hebrew form that is, I won't get into too complicated stuff, but it's the He-Fil form, and the name Yehovah, which comes from Hayahoveh Hiyeh, comes from the Kal form. It's a different form of the verb, and the name Yehovah can mean he was, he is, he is to come. Yahweh can't mean that. It doesn't have that meaning. Mm-hmm. The actual meaning of Yahweh is unclear as well, if it means anything. And why is it unclear? Because they believed it came from some Egyptian deity, so it isn't even Hebrew. Then they say in verse 20 in the English, 21 in the Hebrew. Let me read the Hebrew. It says, Im shachachnu shem Elohenu, if we forgot the name of our God, v'nifros kapenu le'el zar, and we stretched out our hands, our palms, to a foreign God. What does that mean? The way the Israelites would pray, you know, I do this, and some people say, are you a Pentecostal? No, I'm praying like an Israelite. This is how the Israelites would pray. They would stretch up their hands to God, raising their hands. He says, if we forgot the name of our God and we stretched out our palms to a foreign deity, Halo Elohim yachakor zot, will God not investigate this? Ki hu yodea talumot lev, for he knows the mysteries of the heart. That is, I'm in a foreign land, and I grew up being told, you're not allowed to say the name of your God. We have this, and my heart is stirred. I can return to the God of Israel. And this is what it's talking about in Psalm 44. I mean, it literally talks about these people who grew up in Babylon and were told, don't speak the name of your God. And instead, they're calling out the names of Baal and Marduk and who knows what deities, right? Because they don't know any better. But in their hearts, they're turning their hearts towards the one true God, towards the God of Israel in innocence. And so I don't think God is striking people down because they're calling upon God with the wrong name, but it's still important to try to get it right if we can, right? We've been captivated by this falsehood for 200 years since 1833 when Gesenius wrote that, and now we have better information. Surely we should act on that better information. And we were talking before about, you know, from your perspective in the New Testament, you've got Yeshua, and I know there's people who have been saved in the name of Jesus. They'll tell you it was on a certain date with a certain time, and you're not saying, Michael, right, to those people, hey, that salvation experience you had, that was false. You're not saying that, right?
No, that's not the point.
That's not the point we're making here. The point we're making here is, okay, you had that experience. God's that merciful that if you mispronounce his name, that he can still find you where you are. Even if you call him by a mispronunciation based on the name Jupiter, he can still respond to your prayer. He's that amazing, that merciful. But now that we know better, we should return to the truth, doing the best we can with this information as knowledge is being increased.
Was that helpful? Oh, good. Sorry, I cut a lot out because they waffle on quite a bit, so it jumped quite a bit there, because otherwise it would go on for about 55 minutes, all right? The other thing I just wanted to point out today is this parasha is, a lot of it is about warfare. And we sort of touched on that about 2 weeks ago when I spoke about anti-Semitism and the warfare and the things we're into at the moment. I just want to play another video for you. Could you play that for me?
There's no one official definition of anti-Semitism, no common standard to make it simple for researchers to calculate the percentage of people of a certain country, region, or religion who are anti-Semitic. That's because anti-Semitism is measured in perceptions, how people perceive Jews. The Anti-Defamation League, an organization that fights prejudice, is introducing what could become a global baseline measure of anti-Semitism, a survey of over 50,000 people in 96 languages in over 100 countries. It was shared exclusively with the Wall Street Journal. What's the headline? That about a quarter of the world's population holds views of Jewish people that are, by ADL standards, anti-Semitic. What's its standard? The ADL created a questionnaire of 11 anti-Semitic statements or stereotypes, including Jews have too much power in international financial markets, Jews have too much control over the global media, Jews still talk too much about what happened to them in the Holocaust, and people hate Jews because of the way Jews behave. Those who said at least six statements are probably true are considered by the ADL to harbor anti-Semitic attitudes. The ADL's index attempts to leave people's political views on Israeli politics out of its equation. So, based on this index, where is anti-Semitism most prevalent? The Middle East and North Africa region, where 74% of people surveyed held anti-Semitic views. In the West Bank and Gaza, 93%. Iraq, 92%. Iran got the lowest score in the region, 56%. One response in particular is likely to alarm Jewish leaders. Only 38% of people in this region have heard of the Holocaust. Of those who have heard about it, 22% agreed it's been described fairly by history. 63% think the Holocaust was a myth or exaggeration. What region is the least anti-Semitic? That would be the Americas, where less than 1 in 5 people overall hold anti-Semitic views. In the U.S., it's about 1 in 11. What about Europe? In Western Europe, the average score is 24%. But in Eastern Europe and Russia, anti-Semitic attitudes are 10% higher. How do Christians and Muslims worldwide compare? Nearly a quarter of Christians believed six or more of the survey statements. Muslims, around half. This is a sampling of the trove of data in this study. But here's one last factoid. Of the people globally who believe a majority of the anti-Semitic stereotypes are probably true, the vast majority have never met a Jewish person.
Interesting, isn't it? I bring that into play because this week's Torah session was all about our enemies. Our enemies trying to block us, our enemies trying to stand in our way. And in the Haftorah session, our enemies trying to claim what Yah has already given to us. They want us to take a hold of a territory that already belongs to us and take it and call it their own. And I believe that a lot of the error and a lot of the problems we've had throughout history, we even talked, Nehemiah talked about it today, about the Greeks attempting to commit genocide against us by assimilation, to destroy Jewish identity by destroying Torah observance. Because without Torah observance, we're not Jews. That's quite simply it. I mean, you can look at two, are Arabs and Jews separate races? Yes. Yet, genetically, Arabs and Jews are near identical. They're both descended from Abraham. So Arabs and Jews are separate races. Why? Because of the Torah. So one of the ways you can either do what Hitler did, which was try to exterminate all Jews physically, or to eliminate Torah observance. It's the second way of doing it. Okay. I just want to go through a little bit that I've put together. I'm going to take this off because it's annoying me. I can't lean on. Okay. Would you like to put the slide up for this, please? Yep, next one. Okay. The error we find, like last week we talked about the error, and the error with knowing the name is a result of anti-Semitism and attempted genocide by the Greeks, by the Romans, who considered the observance of Torah to be treasonous. Okay. This is given by a speech by a rabbi in front of, I think it was the European Parliament. It's easy to hate, but very difficult to justify hate in public. Throughout history, when people have sought to justify anti-Semitism, they have done so by recourse to the highest source of authority within a culture. In the Middle Ages, it was religion. So we had religious anti-Judaism or anti-Semitism. In post-Enlightenment Europe, it was science. So we had the twin foundations of Nazi ideology, social Darwinism, and so-called scientific study of race. Today, the highest source of authority worldwide is human rights. That's why Israel, the only functioning democracy in the Middle East for the free press and independent judiciary, is regularly accused of the five cardinal sins against human rights: racism, discrimination, apartheid, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and attempted genocide. The new anti-Semitism has mutated so that there's a practitioner of it can deny that he or she is an anti-Semite. After they say, "I'm not a racist, I have no problem with Jews or Judaism, I only have a problem with the state of Israel." But in a world months of nations, I think I've got that wrong, never mind, which constitutes 0.25% of the landmass of the Middle East, and yet Israel is the only one of 193 member states of the United Nations that regularly has its right to exist challenged, with the state of Iran and many other groups committed to its destruction. Anti-Semitism means that the denying the right of Israel's children, whether they are native-born or adopted, to exist as Torah-observant people with the same rights as everyone else. And the denial of Israel's right to exist is the best example. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago when it was brought up that the New Zealand government posted on their website a map excluding Israel from the map. So what were they doing there? They were symbolically committing an act of genocide against the state of Israel. Yeah, it's exactly what they were doing. This is not alone. The founding director of the European Coalition for Israel in Brussels, Thomas Sandel, announced on December the 4th, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel waged a campaign to prevent Central and Eastern European countries from having their capitals moving their embassies to Jerusalem to preserve the Iran nuclear deal. Sandel said, "We have found out something I heard for quite some time already from Central and Eastern European countries that would have an inclination to move their embassies to Jerusalem. This is a natural thing for them to do. They receive phone calls from Berlin from Angela Merkel, the Chancellor. Basically," she said, "this cannot happen under any circumstances." Interesting, isn't it? Germany's UN ambassador, Christoph Hergesen, and the country's UN diplomat had voted 16 times against Israel from a total of 21 anti-Israel resolutions in 2018. Germany only abstained from 4. Okay. Would you like to play the next video, please?
There's unprecedented new warnings today from Germany's, for Germany's Jewish population. A government official is urging them to not wear skull caps in public. This over a rise in anti-Semitism in German society. Tasha Fatah is covering the story for us this morning and joins us now. So, an ominous message, Natasha. Tell us more about it.
This is coming from Felix Klein. He is the official German anti-Semitism commissioner. And he says, based on recent activity throughout the country, the rise of anti-Semitism, he cannot in good faith recommend that Jewish men should wear their skull caps out in public. Now, he made the statement acknowledging that it would be controversial, but he does have the numbers to back him up. When you look at the number of anti-Semitic incidents that have been recorded in 2018, there were more than 1,600. That represents a 10% rise from the year before. And in terms of violent anti-Jewish incidents, in 2018, there were 62. In 2017, there were 37. So that's a huge spike in the numbers. So not only is he saying, he's not saying don't wear them. He's saying I cannot recommend that you wear them in public because you don't know who's going to respond. He's also asking for teachers, lawyers, and police to be trained on how to deal with anti-Semitism. Beyond that, we've heard from the biggest legal mind in Germany, who is an expert on anti-Semitism, saying that prejudice has been part of the German culture, but it was pushed down below the surface. Now, all of a sudden, it feels like it can bubble up again, and people feel like they can talk about these things openly, be hateful openly. And the Minister of Justice in Germany has described the recent rise of anti-Semitism as shameful.
So, Natasha, we know why there is this rise in anti-Semitism.
We have a few reasons why, and they're coming from German officials. They are describing this as a rise of the far right, the white nationalism throughout Europe, but specifically in Germany, leading to a sentiment against various minority groups, including Jews, even though so many Jews say that we and our families have lived in Europe for hundreds of years. But beyond that, in recent years, we've got a spike of Islamist ideology throughout Europe and again in Germany, leading to a sense not only of being anti-Jewish, but also anti-Israel. And so that has led to a spike in anti-Semitism, but also violent incidents. And beyond that, we heard directly from Felix Klein saying that he blamed social media and the internet for giving space to hateful dialogue, hateful messages, and then people feel emboldened because they think a lot more people support them than the actual numbers would indicate.
Okay, I want to correct that because I don't believe that it was coming from the right wing. I don't believe that. I believe that's coming from the government. I believe the government has given the green light to it. She's displayed anti-Semitic behavior and attitude as a government, which has emboldened or created the anti-Semitic environment. I'll give you another example. Donald Trump stated in his election that he was going to move the U.S. Embassy to the U.S. Embassy, just hold on a sec, yeah, to Jerusalem. And next thing you know, we have a massive women's march attacking Donald Trump for saying, well, obviously something stupid, but they attacked him and they went way off the scale on what should be what you would expect for that kind of stupid comment. They went on and on and having marches and marches and marches about it. Later on, it's revealed that the leaders and the heads of this women's march are all anti-Semites. See, like I said before, the new high standard is anti-racism, anti-discrimination, human rights. So they're focusing, saying he's discriminating against women, and that way they get away with pretending not to be anti-Semitic in their attacks on him. Incidentally, are Donald Trump's kids Jewish? Yes. Are his grandkids Jewish? Yes. So their attacks on him are basically rooted in anti-Semitism. Yeah. Personal. So while people, because they're coming at them sideways, so while people who are involved in those marches all think, oh yes, we're doing this for women, we're doing this for anti-discrimination, they're what's the term, Ken? Useful idiots who are being used to destroy someone who was looking after Israel and doing the right thing by Israel. Yeah. Next question is, can someone with Jewish ancestry be an anti-Semite? Yes. Of course they can. Let's have a look at history. Put that one back up. Yeah. Karl Marx, in his book, The Jewish Problem, Marx argues that in the final analysis, the emancipation of the Jews is the emancipation of mankind from Judaism. Yeah, we just talked about that, didn't we? Larry Ray explains Marx's position is example that is exemplary and assimilationist, one where there is no room within emancipated humanity for Jews as a separate ethnic or cultural identity. Next one. Dennis Fishman puts it, Jews, Marx seemed to be saying, can only become free when Jews they are no longer exist. When as Jews they no longer exist. Marx seems fairly to bristle with anti-Jewish sentiments. By anti-Semitism I mean the denial of the right of the Jew to autonomous existence, i.e. to be freely determine his or her own being as a Jew. Okay? Or a Torah observant Messianic Jew. Next one. Has anyone heard of this lady, Stella Kubler? Stella Kubler was a German Jewish woman who collaborated with the Gestapo during World War II, exposing and denouncing Berlin's underground Jews and led to the capture of 3,000 Jews by the Nazis. Yep. Would you like to pay, wait, would you like to play the next video, please? Yeshua said, would you like to bring the next one up? Would you like to bring the PowerPoint up, please? Yeshua said, then his mother and his brothers came to him. They could not reach him because of the crowd, and he was told, your mother and your brothers are standing outside desiring to see you. And he answered them, my mother and my brothers are those who hear the word of God and do it. Yeah. Would you like to play the next video, please?
If you've ever wondered how a Talmudic scholar or an Orthodox Jew or somebody who is both can be a Nazi, all you have to do is ask Google. Incredible piece just popped up on my Facebook feed. This is from Breitbart, Lucas Nolan. You know the Project Veritas dump of information from YouTube and Google yesterday? Internal email from Google in which my colleague, Dennis Prager, is called a Nazi. An observant Jew who writes books on the Old Testament is considered to be a Nazi by Google. As is, in the same email, Ben Shapiro, a kippah-wearing Orthodox Jew. Let's put some names to these individuals. This is an internal conversation. It's an email, Google employee called Liam Hopkins, in his email. If we understand that PragerU, an incredible platform, Prager University, comma, Jordan Peterson, Ben Shapiro et al., are Nazis using dog whistles. Yeah, he says it, are Nazis. This man, Liam Hopkins at Google, continues to go on in an email to somebody called Meredith. I don't think correctly identifying far-right content is beyond our capabilities, but if it is, why not go with Meredith's suggestion of disabling the suggestion feature? Which means, if you're on their platform, they will disable any suggestion in the algorithm, if you're watching something conservative, that you should go and check out Dennis Prager or Ben Shapiro. They've been lying to you for years when they said, in front of Congress, oh, there's no intervention. We don't do that. We're not doing anything like that. We have the emails. They're going to block the suggestion feature of people like Dennis Prager and Ben Shapiro and Jordan Peterson because they deem them to be Nazis. When in fact, that makes them the Nazis. That's the bottom line. Google, you are the Nazis. By secretly censoring freedom of speech and using labels like that against observant Jews, you are the fascists, Google. Meredith, whoever you are, Liam Hopkins, you are fascists. And I hope Donald Trump and his administration and anybody who brings suit in a private court throws the bloody book at you. Right now, you should be cut up into little pieces like the Bell Company was. You should be broken up, or you should be recategorized as a publisher, which will make you liable for all cases of libel. That's your fate in this country.
One of the interesting things we hear all the time is left and right.
I know, sorry. No, he's talking about the mic.
One of the things we hear about is left and right, and different people in different nations have different views of what left and right wing are. For some reason, universities, and especially Europeans, do left and right. Communists are left, Nazis are right. The only problem with that is Nazi doctrine and communist doctrine is almost identical. They're both group identity politics. They're both based on group think. As a matter of fact, in communist ideology, it's called political correctness. In Nazi ideology, it's called Gleichschaltung, which means literally the same thing. Yeah, tuning. Yeah, and they're both socialists. So when you hear that, you know, I explain to people that no, because you know what? In the United States, one of the things that happened in New Zealand when there was a shooting in New Zealand, the first thing I went to look up was there a synagogue in the city in Christchurch? Because why on earth? Because the white supremacists usually target one or two places. They usually target... In the United States, they usually target Protestant, African-American churches or synagogues. And in Europe, they usually target synagogues. So why did he target an Islamic one? And that's where I found out that all synagogues in New Zealand are called progressive. There's no Orthodox synagogues in New Zealand. And if they're like us, like we are here, we have armed guards outside the synagogues when the service is on. And they do there, so they're not an easy target. Yeah, United States not so much because they have a lower percentage of anti-Semitism in the United States. You just saw that. Okay, I just want to play a video by Dinesh D'Souza very quickly. And he's just going to talk a bit about left and right.
He's a fascist. For decades, this has been a favorite smear of the left aimed at those on the right. Every Republican president, for that matter, virtually every Republican, since the 1970s has been called a fascist, now more than ever. This label is based on the idea that fascism is a phenomenon of the political right. The left says it is, and some self-styled white supremacists and neo-Nazis embrace the label. But are they correct? To answer this question, we have to ask what fascism really means. What is its underlying ideology? Where does it even come from? These are not easy questions to answer. We know the name of the philosopher of capitalism, Adam Smith. We know the name of the philosopher of Marxism, Karl Marx. But who's the philosopher of fascism? Yes, exactly. You don't know. Don't feel bad. Almost no one knows. This is not because he doesn't exist, but because historians, most of whom are on the political left, had to erase him from history in order to avoid confronting fascism's actual beliefs. So let me introduce him to you. His name is Giovanni Gentile. Born in 1875, he was one of the world's most influential philosophers in the first half of the 20th century. Gentile believed that there were two diametrically opposed types of democracy. One is liberal democracy, such as that of the United States, which Gentile dismisses as individualistic, too centered on liberty and personal rights, and therefore selfish. The other, the one Gentile recommends, is true democracy, in which individuals willingly subordinate themselves to the state. Like his philosophical mentor Karl Marx, Gentile wanted to create a community that resembles the family, a community where we are all in this together. It's easy to see the attraction of this idea. Indeed, it remains a common rhetorical theme of the left. For example, at the 1984 convention of the Democratic Party, the governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, likened America to an extended family, where, through the government, people all take care of each other. Nothing's changed. 30 years later, a slogan of the 2012 Democratic Party convention was, "The government is the only thing we all belong to." They might as well have been quoting Gentile. Now remember, Gentile was a man of the left. He was a committed socialist. For Gentile, fascism is a form of socialism, indeed, its most workable form. While the socialism of Marx mobilizes people on the basis of class, fascism mobilizes people by appealing to their national identity as well as their class. Fascists are socialists with a national identity. German fascists in the 1930s were called Nazis, basically a contraction of the term National Socialist. For Gentile, all private action should be oriented to serve society. There's no distinction between the private interest and the public interest. Correctly understood, the two are identical. And who is the administrative arm of society? It's none other than the state. Consequently, to submit to society is to submit to the state, not just in economic matters, but in all matters. Since everything is political, the state gets to tell everyone how to think and what to do. It was another Italian, Benito Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy from 1922 to 1943, who turned Gentile's words into action. In his Dottrina del Fascismo, one of the doctrinal statements of early fascism, Mussolini wrote, "All is in the state and nothing human exists or has value outside the state." He was merely paraphrasing Gentile. The Italian philosopher is now lost in obscurity, but his philosophy could not be more relevant because it closely parallels that of the modern left. Gentile's work speaks directly to progressives who champion the centralized state. Here in America, the left has vastly expanded state control over the private sector, from healthcare to banking, from education to energy. This state-directed capitalism is precisely what German and Italian fascists implemented in the 1930s. Leftists can't acknowledge their man Gentile because that would undermine their attempt to bind conservatism to fascism. Conservatism wants small government so that individual liberty can flourish. The left, like Gentile, wants the opposite, to place the resources of the individual and industry in the service of a centralized state. To acknowledge Gentile is to acknowledge that fascism bears a deep kinship to the ideology of today's left. So they will keep Gentile where they've got him, dead, buried, and forgotten. But we should remember, or the ghost of fascism will continue to haunt us. I'm Dinesh D'Souza for Prager University. Thank you for watching this video. To help keep these
videos... Does the mic sense to everyone? Yeah. So with the issue, because I was asked with the issue with Israel Folau, this is the issue with Israel Folau. Do corporations have the right to dictate to individuals what they should and should not believe? Yeah? No. Should the Australian government pass laws that deregisters businesses in Australia who attempt to subvert our constitutional rights? Yeah. So they can't carry on businesses in Australia. So businesses who said, unless you get rid of Israel Folau because he has stated his religious beliefs openly and publicly, should not be able to function in Australia because simply because they have attacked his constitutional rights. Yeah. That's what the fight's about. That's what it's really about. Because these people want to enforce their religious beliefs as the Greeks did, as the Romans did, as the Babylonians did, as the Assyrians did. And ultimately, even though it's not directed against us as Messianic Jews, it's our book. They're coming at us sideways. So if they win with him, then who's next? There's an old saying, they came for the Jews, but I wasn't a Jew, so I didn't worry. They came for, you know, so they're coming for, they're trying to prevent anybody who will speak out and will speak out for God. So just remember to pray for that guy and to pray for what's going on, okay? You may not have approached things as indelicately as he did, but you know what? He should have the right to. And that's a right we need to fight for. Yeah. Okay. Does anyone have any questions about this stuff? I know it's sort of a bit side topic today, but I felt after last time I spoke we needed to cover a few things. Is that all right? Okay, let's move into the issue of remembrance service then.